In the following examples, the first is normal. In the second, the formants have been increased in amplitude by 10% and the pitch raised. In the next, formants have been increased 20% and the pitch also raised. Finally, the formants are up 30% and the pitch 50%.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
The opposite effect is produced by a reduction in formant levels of 10% and 20% respectively.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
Once words are stored in the library in a low bitrate form, we next need some rules for assembling a continuous message from the control parameters for the isolated words. First, we must make a calculation of the word duration data in the context of this message. In other words, we type in some message, and we must determine how long to make each word in the message in the context of this specific message. There are several ways in which this can be done. For example, one might measure the durations from a natural version of that sentence and then put it in directly into the program to test it out. One could use table lookup of the data. One could determine the duration as a function of the specific context, store it in a table, and then be able to look that up. A sophisticated way of doing this is by rule based on a syntactic analysis of the text of the message. A last way is to use a fixed duration for each word independent of context. And the more limited the situation in which you're using it, the more appropriate would be something as simple as keeping the duration fixed. Once timing data has been obtained, the next most important piece of supersegmental data is this pitch data, getting external pitch contour variation for the utterance. And there are several ways in which we can get that data. We could store a fixed contour and use it for that utterance. And this might be good if one's answer back system were always supplying a fixed type of message. One could merge together the pitch from the isolated words. We have the pitch parameter coming in. One could use those. But those tend to characterize the word primarily in isolation. And when merged, don't generally yield acceptable pitch contours. One could go out and measure the pitch contour from a natural version of the utterance. And again, the most sophisticated way is to make a by-rule calculation based on a stress analysis of the sentence. Once pitch and timing data have been obtained, one then must merge together the remaining form and control parameters from the isolated words to give a smooth, continuous track of each of these control parameters. This merging and interpolation involves two things. One, lengthening or shortening the duration of the individual words to conform with the timing data that we've just generated. This is primarily done based on the spectral derivative. That is, the amount, the rate of change of the word, of the form and control parameters during the word. If one wants to shorten a word, we merely remove those sections where the parameters are least changing. Similarly, if one wants to lengthen a word, one finds the region where they're least changing and then lengthens it in that region. Finally, at the juncture between two voice sounds, that is, when one word ends in a voiced region and the next word begins in a voiced region, we must interpolate the form and contours to preserve the smooth form and transitions. The next slide,
look at figure 4,
shows a typical example of word concatenation, and we'll see some of these effects. Here we begin with four isolated words, word 1 through word 4. These are the natural durations as measured from our analysis program. And word 1 is all voiced, shown by three form and tracks. Word 2 begins unvoiced and goes into voiced. Word 3 begins unvoiced and begins voiced and goes into unvoiced, and word 4 is again all voiced. First thing we do is calculate D1 through D4, the durations in the context of this message, and the message is word 1 through word 2 through word 3 through word 4. Then one calculates a pitch contour variation to correspond to this message. Then one takes the control parameters for word 1 and adjusts the duration to match D1, since there's no merging at the juncture. For word 2, the same thing happens, except at the juncture between word 2 and word 3, they're both voiced. And hence, for example, if we look at, say, the first formant, it's quite high at the end of word 1 and quite low at the beginning of word 2. In the merged interpolated version for the continuous utterance, one must somehow interpolate between the high level here and the low level here, and we have a smoothing interpolation algorithm which does this. Similarly, we finish word 3 and go right, which ends in unvoiced, then go into word 4 directly. We have a demonstration of this type of synthesis for the sentences we heard, the sentence we heard before, where we took the isolated words of the sentence "we were away a year ago" and first merely took the isolated words and put them together one right after the other. Then we actually did interpolation merging of the form shown here, by rule determination of timing and pitch and our concatenation of the forming controls. So first we'll hear isolated words put together, and then the by rule calculation.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
Three different speakers' voice patterns were used to prepare the examples here.
We have also used this system to automatically generate seven-digit numbers in the form of telephone numbers. In this case, we've used a table lookup of the digit duration, where we've actually tabulated the duration of a digit as a function of context. That is, its position in the digit string, since there are only one of seven positions a digit can assume. We've used the fixed carrier phrase, the number is, and we've used a single archetypal pitch contour for seven-digit strings. This is the case where we found that the situation is identical from utterance to utterance, so we could use a fixed contour. The next slide.
Now turn to figure 5.
So it's a spectrographic comparison between an original version of one of these utterances, the number is 1353201, and our concatenated version. And we see that the timing matches reasonably well, and the Forman tracks tend to match reasonably well between the two versions. I'd now like to play a tape demonstration of digit strings generated by this method. First, we'll hear telephone numbers where the numbers were merely abutted, one right after the other. Next, we've used our rules for timing, pitch, and we've performed the interpolation merging of the control parameters.
The number is 091109. The number is 091109. The number is 13532001. The number is 1353201.
We have made an experimental evaluation of the communicative effectiveness of concatenated speech in this digit dialing situation. We compared four types of speech. These consisted of 1, naturally spoken seven-digit telephone numbers; 2, naturally spoken isolated digits abutted together; 3, synthetic isolated digits abutted together; and 4, concatenated digits. Listeners were seated in a sound booth and heard these telephone numbers over a standard touch-tone telephone. They were required to dial the number they had just heard after a prescribed delay of 1 or 5 seconds, and the delay was indicated by a light seen in the booth. The next slide.
Look at figure 6.
Shows the number of errors in dialing for 12 subjects, which we had in this test. And in this slide, we have plotted the number of digit errors in 4,200 digits for the 12 subjects, as well as the number of telephone number errors in 600 telephone numbers. These lower curves here are for 1 second delay conditions. The solid ones are for the number of digit errors and refer to this axis. The dashed ones are the number of telephone number errors and refer to the right-hand axis. The upper curves are the same results for 5 seconds delay. An analysis of variance of the data of this experiment showed there were no significant differences between the natural speech type 1 and the synthetic concatenated type 4 at the 95% level. However, a difference existed between natural or synthetic concatenated 1 and 4 and natural isolated or synthetic isolated types 2 or 3, and the differences was significant at the 95% level. The conclusion from this experiment was that the synthesis program was significantly reducing the number of errors over that which would have been obtained by merely abutting the speech.
I'd like to ask Jim Flanagan, who has joined us, to explain some of the technical terms used in the talk you just heard. Jim, what are these formants that Larry referred to?
The three formant frequencies that are useful in speech synthesis represent the first three resonances of the vocal tract. These resonances typically vary slowly with time. For a man whose vocal tract is about 17 centimeters in length, these resonances fall in the nominal regions around 500 hertz, 1500 hertz, and 2500 hertz, respectively.
The pitch of the source was one of the things that was changed, as well as its amplitude. But what kind of waveform is used for the source, that is, to represent the operation of our larynx?
The wave shape for voiced sounds is essentially a pulse generator that issues periodic pulses the period of which is controlled by the pitch control signal for the synthesizer. The wave shape used for voiceless sounds, the consonant sounds, is a random noise source, or in the digital format, a random number generator.
Larry spoke of the synthesizer, but we didn't get a very good feel for its size. Is it bigger than a bread box, or just how big?
The synthesizer that we have been using in our facility is essentially a digital filter. It's implemented in integrated circuits. It is a size that is easily held in the two hands. That is, it's fitted into a rack very conveniently. And in our case, we use a laboratory computer to issue coefficient data to the digital filter. The resonances of the digital filter are controlled in accordance with these data, and these data, of course, represent the resonances of the vocal tract and also the excitation. The computer that controls it, in our case, we're using the BDP-516 machine, which is an integrated circuit computer. In our case, we have a 16K core storage, 960 nanosecond cycle time, and some backup disk.
And Jim, without going into the details of the computer and program, would you give us some idea of the cost of performing these synthesis operations, say in computer time?
Perhaps the best way to answer that is in terms of what's required in running time on the machines that we are using. In the formant synthesis approach, the synthesis can be made upwards of 10 times real time, so that the computer could serve up to about 10 synthesizers or 10 answer back channels. The text synthesis, which requires more computation and is a more sophisticated or complex calculation, runs just about real time. It also depends upon its dictionary presently being stored in a larger computer that we communicate with via a data loop.
Thanks for those explanations, Jim. Now let's hear Bill Chapman of IBM's Advanced Technology Group in Raleigh, North Carolina, explain and demonstrate a different approach to synthesis, one in which the building blocks, called diphones, begin on one sound and end on another. One merit here is that the operation of bridging sounds to form strings of words doesn't require additional basic sound elements.
Now let's examine purely synthetic speech, which is generated by a combination of stored basic speech units called diphones and a set of rules to control diphone length within and between words, as well as pitch contours across individual words or whole messages. All the messages you will hear have been composed from a basic set of approximately 600 diphones capable of generating in a stylized manner practically any desired message. Less than 100 have been employed in these particular messages. Stress and pitch contour have been applied only within individual words and not across the entire message.
All this being seven, consult, taken, number, changed, mistake, working, W.
Next, listen to a complete message containing a single stress and pitch contour. The same contours are applicable to other messages of this general type, where the individual words may be variables. Note that all words may be variables in the message format. Here the words have been joined by diphones, selected solely on the basis of diphone names of the adjacent words. A common pitch and lengthening pattern, or stress pattern, has been applied.
The number you dialed, ME15280, has been changed. The new number is PA61347. This is the recording. The number you dialed, UN44482, has been temporarily disconnected. Thank you. I'm sorry you reached this office by mistake. Please consult your directory and dial again.
Synthetic speech of this type affords the generation of new words and a wide variety of messages without seeking the services of a live talker each time a new word is desired. However, the generation of continuous text with a variety of appropriate sentence melody contours requires considerable sophistication in the rules for analyzing connected text and interpreting these rules to control pitch, amplitude, and length to form truly natural-sounding sentences.
While short messages are coded from analysis of human voice patterns, the formant patterns for speech to be synthesized from text must be calculated based on some type of model. In the case of work of this type at Bell, dynamics for the calculated control parameters are based on a computer model of the human voice mechanism. Dr. Coker explains some of the requirements for such a model.
We're trying to work from a large vocabulary. Therefore, we must fabricate words. We don't want to tolerate for our small computer the storage. To do that, we're doing it with a synthesis, with a model of the mouth. But to control that model of the mouth, we must supply stress and timing and pauses and so forth. At this stage, we'll say that we are doing that at some high level where physically we know the stress on this word, where in the sentence there's going to be a pause, what kind of inflection we're going to put on the word. And then those assignments have to be translated into explicit controls for the synthesizer. We're synthesizing with formants, but we're doing it with a model of the mouth. And this model has some physical constraints to its shape. It's controlled by the parameters, main body of the tongue, tongue tip, lips. This model has defined for it the phonemes that we're going to use for synthesis. And each phoneme has defined for it a shape. In some cases, the diphthongs, two shapes. But nevertheless, we define target shapes. And this model has associated with it a dynamics. And we go from one target shape to another with a natural dynamics of the model. And there are two kinds of constraints involved in control of this model. One of them is a physiological constraint, the natural speeds with which this model can move. You can move the tongue tip more rapidly than you can move the tongue body, slightly. You can close the lips rapidly, but you can round them only slowly. It illustrates a property of nature that somehow nature is managing to force discrete symbols through this system at a more rapid rate than the Nyquist limit for those discrete symbols. The duration of D is too short to be resolved by the tongue tip if you had to make a rapid oscillation between D and something else. And it manages to do that by overlapping critical movements. It assigns this critical task to that guy and this one to that one and this one to that one. It allows two of them to work on their jobs at the same time. And we are doing it with a priority system. And that's a linguistic constraint, a property of the language that each phoneme has defined for it. If it has a critical property like raised tongue tip for a D, that phoneme gets control of the tongue tip early and releases it late, whereas B gets control of the lips early and releases them late. And there exists a time where the control to form D and the control to form B are applied at the same time, so that in the end, the tongue tip is still up at the moment the lips get closed, so that it says goodbye, not goodbye.
It should be clear that the digital computer and programs developed to analyze and simulate the human voice are major tools of the speech engineer of today. Although what you have heard demonstrated here represents principally laboratory-level work, there are commercial equipments used in voice answerback, controlled by computer systems, now in use in telephone systems, credit checking systems, and similar applications. Bill Chapman describes two such systems.
Although we see new applications arising in the manufacturing and educational marketplace, the main use of voice response today is the telephone inquiry environment in conjunction with computers having large databases available for data entry and data inquiry. In Type A systems, speech is stored in the voice response unit itself, usually in separately addressable words or short phrases, such that a wide variety of messages may be produced. In both schemes, input questions or data are routed directly to the computer where the necessary response is determined based either on information stored in the computer, files, or on the results of some computation. In Type A, the digital addresses of the words or phrases are then sent back to the voice response unit, and a sequence of stored speech units is selected and routed to the appropriate interrogating line. In Type B systems, the speech itself is stored in digital form on the system files along with the data to be accessed. In this case, Digitally encoded speech is sent back to the vocoder synthesizer or other type of digital-to-analog converter and reconstituted into speech. An example of the Type A configuration is the IBM 7770 audio response unit. Here, the basic time slot for a stored word is 1/2 second, where the words are stored on a magnetic drum. Each word has the same pitch contour, generated exactly as it was recorded by the talker. More than one pitch contour on a given word may be obtained at the expense of an additional time slot. For most business applications, this type of response seems adequate with good intelligibility, but no sentence continuity. In fact, critical digital information presented in this manner has been shown in some cases to be more intelligible than digits smoothed together for naturalness. In applications such as telephone intercept, where the messages are to be heard by naive users, the use of short, connected phrases improves message continuity considerably. These phrases usually occupy 2 or more 1/2 second time slots. An example of the Type B configuration, if you remember earlier, is the IBM 7772 audio response unit. Since speech is stored in variable record lengths on the system files, there is no requirement for fitting words or phrases into discrete time slots. In this device, speech data encoded at an average rate of 2400 bits per second is transmitted to a pitch-excited vocoder synthesizer dedicated to each output line, where it is converted back into an analog signal. This type of system is suitable for a small number of lines because of the moderate per-line hardware costs and its large impact on the host computer resulting from high channel data rates when outputting speech, but it is capable of operating with a large and expandable vocabulary.
There are several other manufacturers of segmented, that is Chapman's Type A, voice response units, which admittedly have the merit of lowest cost. The techniques used for speech synthesis for any given application can match the versatility and speech intelligibility requirements of that application, with system cost, of course, varying accordingly. Now looking to the future, there are several speech analysis applications. Jim, I've heard that the easiest of these, though still quite complex, is speaker verification. How does that work?
If a speaker could be verified automatically by voice, there might be a number of business transactions that could be conducted by voice over telephone channels. One possibility that comes to mind is the voice banking situation, where it might be convenient for an individual to dial his bank and inquire about his bank balance. One possibility is for the machine to come on and, via synthetic speech, ask him to state a verification phrase. The speaker offers a sample, and the machine proceeds to compare that sample against what it has stored as a reference for that individual. If the match or distance between the measures features is close enough, the machine decides to accept the individual as who he claims to be. If it's not close enough, then the machine states that a verification is not possible and either asks for another trial or asks for the individual to verify himself in some other way. One has typically a cooperative population, a population that wants to be verified and is willing to use tailor-made verification phrases in order to facilitate the verification. In some instances, if, say, the transfer of a large sum of money is involved, one might never wish to miss, that is, avoid at all cost making a false acceptance. In that case, one is willing to false alarm at a higher rate in order to ensure that misses are low. On the other hand, if the gravity of the transaction is not so great, then one probably wishes to avoid insulting the customer by false alarming and having him redo the verification, and it may be willing to accept a higher rate of misses.
What are these features or measures which you mentioned?
In our present experiments on computer verification of speakers, the features that we found useful some are identical to those that we used for computer synthesis of speech. Specifically, the pitch variation of the voice during the required utterance or the verification utterance is one feature. The temporal pattern of energy is another, and the time course of the three formants constitute other information that the machine finds useful in making a verification.
I would imagine that the quality of transmission from the speaker to the verification system would have some influence on the ability to correctly verify an individual. Is that true?
In our work, we have been particularly interested in choosing features for verification that are what you might call robust and relatively insensitive to vagaries in the transmission system. We have chosen pitch contour and formant frequencies specifically for this reason. These features are left quite intact by a transmission system that may have a few hills and dales in its frequency response. A system that relied upon, say, matching the pattern of amplitude versus frequency would be affected by vagaries in the transmission system.
Now, going one step beyond verification is speaker recognition. How does that complicate the problem, Jim?
Verification seems to be presently a more tractable problem than speaker recognition. In the case of verification, an identity is claimed, and the machine simply has to decide whether to accept the individual as who he claims to be or to reject him. That is, to supply one bit of information, a go-no-go type of decision. In the case of recognition, the individual offers a sample and, in effect, says, "Who am I?" In which case, the machine has to compare that sample against all stored elements of its library and then find the one that matches the closest.
Thus far, speech analysis has avoided that ultimate development, the ability to convert from spoken language directly into printed text. Will we ever have machines which can eliminate the need for a secretary to take dictation?
It's been pointed out in the journal literature, for example, that to accomplish this satisfactorily, the machine has got to achieve a level of understanding comparable to that that the secretary has in analyzing what's being said. Presently, we are nowhere near knowing enough about constraints, semantic constraints, syntactical constraints, to build these into a machine and accomplish speech recognition in this very general sense. For some time now, since even the early 40s, we've had good knowledge about limited applications of what you might call speech recognition, but what I would prefer to call voice-actuated devices or voice-actuated switches. And that is, if you're willing to restrict the speech vocabulary to a small number of distinctly uttered words, and if you're willing to restrict the user population to a reasonably small number, then one can achieve good performance in these voice-actuated tasks or these voice-switching tasks.
I might add that there may be some psychological reasons why men with attractive secretaries might not want to have a machine even if one did exist. Say, Jim, what do you see as the future of the speech recognition field?
In connection with future of speech recognition, one point that seems worth making is that understanding and insight about speech recognition might come more from understanding and insight about speech synthesis and how to synthesize acceptable speech sounds than from pattern matching approaches and similar examinations that have been customarily made in speech recognition.
Well, Jim, we've about run out of time. Before we go, this is your soundings editor, Walt Beam, with a suggestion that you read the October 1970 Spectrum article, Synthetic Voices for Computers, prepared by some of the individuals you've heard here. An additional reference is Jim Flanagan's own book, Speech Analysis, Synthesis, and Perception, published by Academic Press, with a second edition due in 1972 by Springer Verlag. Another classic in the field is Visible Speech by Potter, Kopp, and Green, now available in paperback form from Dover Press. Before we go, Dr. Coker's computer has told us that it has a few last words.
This is the computer talking. It's been a pleasure communicating with you both through visual displays and now with computer-synthesized speech.